Kind of jumped around a little bit last week. Just to put things in a chronological perspective, I'm just going to quickly just kind of superficially look at this period of time, especially after the death of Alexander, which he died, in 323, and then they started fussing and fighting over who's going to have control of his empire. And basically, it was divided up into four different groups. Primarily, you're looking at, you've got Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. The ones that we're kind of zeroing in on are Ptolemy and Seleucus, because the Ptolemies took control of Egypt, but they also came up the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and they wanted control of Jerusalem. So the Seleucids, the first guy, general, took he staked his claim in Babylon, but then he moved west pretty quickly. And he came down into northern Syria after taking eastern Turkey, and so there was a lot of back and forth between he and Ptolemy and fighting over Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was kind of caught in the vice there for quite a long period of time. And we'll take note of some of those. And then you move on down through this list of the Ptolemies and the Seleucid rule, which takes you down actually to about 143, from 331 to 143. So from 331 to 143, this whole region was Hellenized. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. That is the influence of the Greek culture, language, religion, everything. Everything that was Greek was stamped upon that, 3,000 square miles of territory going all the way over to India, western India, and up north a little bit. I'm sorry. Huh?
3 million, not
3,000. Okay, 3 million. I meant to say million. About 1,000 million, what's the difference, right? 1,000. Times 1,000, a factor of 1,000, right? Okay. Because 1,000 thousands is 1,000,000, right? All right. Okay. So, anyway, that takes us down to 143, where we'll encounter the Hasmonean rules, which is a product of the Maccabean Revolt, which was in that handout tonight. And then we'll get into the Roman rule. All right, now, when we get over here to the actual timeline, you see some names you might recognize, like Plato, 420-ish, Aristotle. In fact, Aristotle taught Alexander the Great, and then Alexander the Great was born in 356, and then he died in 323, and we talked about that last week. And by the way, his only legitimate, quote unquote, son. Nobody knows how many illegitimate children he had. That was probably a bunch. But his only legitimate son was born after he died. So his wife Roxana was pregnant whenever he died. And then he was killed. The youngster was killed when he was 12 years old, lest he try to lay claim to the throne, which was a pretty common practice, and we'll see that. If somebody got in the way, even your own son, you just killed him. Or if he was your brother, you killed him, or had him killed. And that those were not nice people. There's a spider between me and that screen. Not anymore. So, he was murdered when he was 12 years old, which would have been around 310. So, about 310 or 300-ish, 301 or so, essentially the empire had been divided into four main segments, and we looked at that map last week. And then there was kind of a consolidation of some of these regions over the course of time. And you notice from 300 to 200, there's not a lot that's even indicated on this this timeline here. And in fact, in the material that I presented to you, I basically skipped 200 years. Let's see, on page 30. Under the Seleucid and Ptolemaic dynasties. Does everybody have page 30? Okay. Look at the bottom. The numbers are on the bottom of the pages. Really? This page that says the Seleucid and the Ptolemaic dynasties, you didn't have a page 30 on it?
I'm looking at the wrong page 30.
You look at the other page 30. Oh, okay. No. That one doesn't have any page numbers because I told you I wanted to confuse you as much as possible. All right. And I figured you'd lay awake all night trying to figure out where it went. But I told you you could put it anywhere you want to, just so you remember where it is. This was a test. Okay. The page 30. The space between the first and the second paragraph is about a 200-year blank. And it's this 200 years right here, between 300 and 200, that I really didn't want to take the space to write much in there, because there's not a whole lot in there that has a direct bearing upon our study. There's some, minor things that go on there, but for the most part, it's not anything that's particularly significant. But as you get down to that paragraph that begins, Rome had begun to flex her muscles, then we're talking about some things that are germane to the outcome of the events back east. There was a long-standing battle between the Romans and the Carthaginians. Now, you can visualize the Mediterranean Sea and the boot tip of Italy, and then there's Sicily, and then, if you can pound a driver across the water, you can get over to Carthage from the end of Sicily. I don't know what, 50 miles or something like that. If you can hit a long drive, then you can get over there. It's not that far. But so the Carthaginians and the Romans fought each other for a long period of time. I think there were three or four different wars, something like that. Well, in this particular juncture, the Romans subdued Carthage. And we talked about how Hannibal, who was a Carthaginian, had essentially lost the last battle of this particular era to the Roman general. And so they made peace, and then he hooked them out of Dodge. And he went east. And so he allied himself with the Seleucid king, Antiochus III. And Antiochus III was trying to conquer all of Western Asia, which would be modern-day Turkey. And remember, the western end of Turkey was Greece, was Greek. The Greeks settled all of the western side of what we know of as Turkey today. Ephesus, Pergamum, Smyrna, Thyatira was further east, but right along the western shore there. All up and down the western shore of Turkey, today's Turkey. Those were all Greek settlements. Halicarnassus and others. So he was moving quickly into that region, and so it behooved him to make as many allies as possible as he moved into that region. At the same time, Philip of Macedon, and now this is not Alexander the Great's father, that was Philip of Macedon too, but this is Philip V. He's trying to marshal his forces, and he wants to, reestablish Macedonia. as a force against Rome. And so he knows he can't do it by himself. He makes a bargain with Antiochus. Now, mentioned that Hannibal had gone over to Antiochus, and so with Hannibal's help and military expertise, Antiochus had moved all the way through Asia, crossed the Hellespont, which is over into Europe, from Asia into Europe, and Thrace, which is, if you can visualize where Istanbul is today, right there at the mouth of the Bosphorus. Thrace comes down, and it's the western end of the Black Sea, the Sea of Marmara, coming up from the Aegean Sea, and so they're moving into that area right there. And making some significant progress. But then in the meantime, the Romans don't like what's going on, right? And so they're trying to persuade the Italians and the Greeks on the Greek peninsula, okay, where Athens is and Corinth, and although they have a little trouble with the Corinthians, but Corinth and back towards Italy, if they don't join with the Romans, then Antiochus is going to run them out of their country. So they're very persuasive, and so many of the people align themselves with Rome. Some align themselves with Macedonia. It's kind of a mixture in there. Now, mentioned that the Romans. The other thing that we wanted to mention is that part of the bargain of Antiochus with Philip of Macedon is that if they gained control of the whole region, including Egypt, then they would just divvy up the prize of Egypt. So there was more motivation there for Philip, and as well as Antiochus. So finally, the Romans and these forces of Antiochus met at Thermopylae, which is that famous battle site that we mentioned, where you go back to the 300 Spartans. That was another battle, though. That was in 480 BC. But anyway, and the end result of that was that the Roman forces absolutely slaughtered Antiochus's forces and drove him clear off the peninsula back into Asia. And then he was finally killed rather ignominiously in 187. And his son, Seleucus IV, inherited the throne. And that's where I think that other chart picked up, was Seleucus IV kind of taking control of what was or the remainder of the Seleucid Empire. Now, obviously, Seleucus has a problem. The Romans are breathing down his neck. His forces have been on the run. They've been defeated by the Romans. This hasn't really worked out too well with his alliance, the alliance between the Macedonians and the Seleucids. And so they need to try to reinvigorate that. So Seleucus figures that what he needs to do is, again, make an alliance with the son of Philip, whose name is Persusus. Now, Persusus was a nice guy. His brother Demetrius had been taken captive by the Romans in an earlier Macedonian conflict, and they took him off to Rome. And what the Romans, they're slick. They weren't dumb. What the Romans did is that they would take a prominent person, like the son of a king, captive, take him to Rome and tell the people back in Macedonia, in this case, if you guys cause any trouble, we're going to kill the heir, whose name, in this case, it was Demetrius. So that was an incentive for the locals to behave themselves. Well, After things kind of smoothed out and Demetrius came back to Macedonia, his brother, Perseus, who really wanted the throne. Demetrius was in line, but he wanted it. Well, he persuaded his father that the Romans had brainwashed him while he was in Rome, and really he was just kind of a Benedict Arnold, that he had betrayed them. And so he, you know, first his father didn't believe him, but you know, finally Perseus just persisted, I guess. And so Philip finally believed him, and so he poisoned him, his own son. Okay, he poisoned Demetrius, which set the stage for Perseus to take control of the Macedonian, the remainder of the Macedonian Empire. Well, in the meantime, in order to sort of solidify an alliance between the Seleucids and the Macedonians, Seleucid gave his daughter, one of his daughters, to Perseus as a wife. This was for a long, 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 long time the way kings made allies, is they would marry one of their daughters to a son in another kingdom in order to, ostensibly anyway, kind of smooth things over. I guess the thought was you don't go killing your in-laws, although they killed their own sons, but, you know. But this went on for centuries. You might remember. I didn't know it until we were in Vienna a few years ago, whenever it was, 2003 years ago. That's the way Napoleon made peace with the people that ruled in Europe for so long. Oh, their castles in Vienna. But it starts with an H. What?
Habsburgs.
Yeah, the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs. Yeah, that's the way he made. He was very fearful of fighting the Habsburgs because they'd been ruling for such a long period of time that he finally figured out that, well, what he needs to do is marry one of the daughters of Franz Joseph, and then everything will be cool. And it turned out that worked out for him pretty much that way. So this was nothing new. This intermarriage between opposing or possibly hostile forces to form an alliance, and that's what Seleucus did with Perseus. Now, Perseus thought, well, okay, now's the time to move to Greece. All right, we've got the Seleucids on our side, so we'll just move into Greece. He sent some forces, expeditionary forces, down into the Greek peninsula, but then he also moved into Western Asia. The king of Pergamum, who lived up on top of that tall mountain in Pergamos. I was going to pop up a picture of that, and I didn't get around to it. Eumenides. And if you look up Eumenides, you're going to find out there's more than one, like there are a bunch of different Ptolemies, a bunch of different Seleucids. But this Eumenides, he didn't like his playground being disturbed by the Macedonians and or the Seleucids. And so he thought he could just run to Rome and cry on their shoulder, and they could take care of the problem. Well, the word got out that he was going to Rome to squeal on Perseus. So he sent a hitman to Rome to kill the hitman. Unfortunately, fortunately for the hitman, I suppose, he failed. He didn't accomplish that. But what it did was it really stirred up the Romans to the point that they decided, okay, enough of this Macedonian nonsense. This has been going on too long. We're gonna clean their clock. So they sent 17,000 of their best troops over into Macedonia, and they did. In the Battle of Pydna in 168, they once and for all took care of the Macedonians. Then Macedonia was divided up into four different Roman territories. And the Romans maintained an iron-fisted control over that divided Macedonia. So what was the first in the sense of primary city in Macedonia that we're well familiar with from our New Testament studies? No. There's a book in the New Testament. Philippi. Philip of Macedon, Alexander's father, the Philippian letter was written to the Christians in Philippi. So there's a connection. Connect the dots. Philip of Macedon, primary city in that region, which is Philippi is more or less at the very, if you draw a line straight up the middle of the Aegean Sea till you hit land and then you go inland about 20 miles, that's where Philippi was. Right on the main road from the east to the west. It was the main, I-5, I-Philippi. Going from the Asia all the way across into to Europe and then northern Italy and down into Rome. So, and then also it would go down to Greece to Corinth and in Cenchrea. So that, again, a familiar territory, and there the Romans finally took care of the problem. All right. Now, in the meantime, back at the ranch, the Romans heard what Antiochus was trying to do in Italy. Antiochus figures, hey, you know what? The Romans are all engaged with the Macedonians. There's all this fussing and fighting going on with Western Asia, Macedonia, over to Greece. They're just preoccupied with that. I can just sneak into Egypt, take over Egypt, and they won't even know what hit them. They forgot that they had spy satellites, monitoring what was going on down there in Egypt. But anyhow, Antiochus attacks Alexandria. If you visualize the Nile River and the Nile Delta, it's like a triangle. Almost at the west, I don't know what branch of the Nile that is that goes west into the Mediterranean, but right there is where Alexandria was. Alexandria was, I guess for all intents and purposes, the prominent city in Egypt at this time, for a long time. By the way, I wonder who planted the seed in Alexandria to get that city going. Big bang, big boy. Alexander the Great. Yes, good guess. Alexander the Great. Now, Alexandria was probably the busiest, one of the busiest commercial centers in the Eastern Mediterranean. All of the grain that came out of Egypt came through the port of Alexandria. They fed a lot of the Mediterranean. So there was a tremendous amount of commerce there in Alexandria. Since it was essentially a Greek city, because Alexander the Great had colonized it and established it, it was, again, for all intents and purposes, Greek. It had one of the largest libraries of the ancient world. The other one was in a place where we have already mentioned. I don't know. Does anybody know where that was? We've already talked about it. It's renowned for the paper that was used in the library there. It's Pergamum. Yeah, Pergamum. Pergamum had a library that almost rivaled the one in Alexandria. But anyway, they had this tremendous library there and a large Jewish settlement. What in the world would have drawn the Jews to Alexandria? Oh, yes. They were pretty industrious when it came to commerce, trade, business, as well as the fact that some of them had been transported down there. Okay. So there were a lot of people, that is a large number of Jews there in Alexandria. Now, at the bottom of page 30, I note that he invaded, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, this is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. That's a name that you want on your refrigerator door, I'm sure. Because he is the main protagonist that led to the Maccabean uprising. And he's also one of the main characters that's spoken about at the end of the book of Daniel. And we will look at that passage in depth. But Antiochus Epiphanes was one of the most despicable characters of history of that era. He was rotten to the core, to say the least. So here he is down there. He thinks he's going to take care of Egypt, finally get rid of that Ptolemy thorn that's in his flesh. But lo and behold, the Roman consulate comes up to him and says, go away. Go home. He says, I'll think about that. And so, allegedly, the story is that the Roman official took his stick and drew a circle around Antiochus and said, you'll give me an answer before you step outside that circle. And so now the wheels start turning. He thinks about that about, 4 nanoseconds and decides that he doesn't want to have to fight the Roman Empire. And so he says, good idea. I think I'll leave. And so he heads back up the coast towards Jerusalem. The Seleucids in the western quadrant of their territory made their headquarters in Damascus in Syria. But they, as they moved south, they came through Jerusalem, going down to Egypt. So on his way back, he decides that he's going to take all his wrath out upon Jerusalem and Judea, which, of course, eventually results in that Maccabean revolt that we'll be talking about. He ravaged the city. He killed many of the Jews. He made the Jewish religion, the practice of it, a capital offense. If you were caught with a copy of the scriptures or anything that even alluded to them, you were killed. He forbade circumcision. He forbade anything that had to do with Judaism. And so you can imagine what kind of turmoil there was. On the other hand, the Ptolemies more or less stayed in control in that region of Egypt until 30 BC. So they continued on, and of course, a name that lives forever in antiquity is Cleopatra, was the one that her devious scheming is the one that finally led to the Roman conquest of Egypt. Now, you say, what does all this have to do with the Bible? Well, we'll look at Daniel, look at some of the things, but if you can visualize your geography, you've got Egypt, you've got the whole eastern end of the Mediterranean, all the way back up to the Aegean Sea, all of southern Turkey, Greece, Macedonia at the top of the Aegean Sea, and clear east past Babylon, the Tigris and the Euphrates River, all the way almost to India, with this gargantuan stamp of Greece on it. And so this immersion of this whole region into the Grecian culture, that is the way they thought, the way they dressed, et cetera, et cetera, is what's called Hellenization. And this is the middle of page 31. If you have page 31 or don't have page 31, and this is the real page 31 that has a 3-1 at the bottom. Everybody got that one? Okay. We're at the middle, cultural immersion. There are many, 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 many books that have been written about this period of time. Charles Pfeiffer is one of the best known between the Testaments. He talked about how the Grecian soldiers and their paramours would commit lewd acts in the temple. They had these drunken orgies worshiping their god of the wine, Bacchus, and they tried to make that compulsory. They tried to force the Greek style of athletics upon the Jews with the young men participating in the games in the nude, which outraged many of the Jews. They tried to force surgery upon the males that had been circumcised to make it look like they were uncircumcised. It went on for an extended period of time. Now, one piece of noteworthy information at the end of that paragraph, that first paragraph, make note of the fact that the people that opposed Hellenization were called the Hasidim, and that literally means the pious, and this was the forerunner of the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the pious ones. That is the way they perceived themselves anyway. And we know that there are numerous encounters between Jesus and the Pharisees that we're going to be reading about in the New Testament as we study in our Sunday morning quarter coming up this next time, as well as our own study here. Now, this goes on, they say, for over 200 years, and if if you and your kids and their kids and their kids are growing up in a culture that speaks Greek, then guess what? Pretty soon, they don't speak or read Hebrew. Well, takes us back to Alexandria. Remember that large library and a large contingent of Jews and many Jewish scholars were in Alexandria. So, if we want our people to read the Bible, in this case, the Old Testament, they need a Greek version, since they can't read Hebrew. And so in, 250? Yeah, 250. 250, they start to translate the entire Old Testament into Greek. This project lasted, about 100 years, isn't it? I don't have that timeline in front of me. About 100 years it took them to do it. They didn't have Google Translate, okay? So it took them a little longer. The end product is called the Septuagint. That is an important fact to remember. If you read in books, oftentimes, rather than the Septuagint, it'll just have the Roman numerals LXX in referring to this Greek version of the Old Testament. It was still in use, of course, in Jesus' day. It wasn't the only version, but it was the most often used version of the Old Testament because, again, we're talking the common language of the culture was the Koine Greek, K-O-I-N-E, Koine, that means common, the common man's language of the street, okay? Not the classical Aristotle, Plato kind of Greek, but the ordinary folks kind of Greek, Koine Greek. That is the language of the New Testament. That's the language that the New Testament books were written in, was Koine Greek, the original copies of the New Testament. So, again, we see God's providential working all through this period of time in orchestrating the power, the powers that be, the language, all in fulfillment of the prophecies that were made that we've looked at, particularly in the book of Daniel. Daniel, the 8th chapter, as we talked about how Greek overthrew the Medo-Persian Empire. Right? Then the Medo-Persian Empire was overthrown by that fourth world empire, which we know is Rome, and we'll be eventually talking about that. Now, one other note, piece of what I thought was worthy information, worth our notation, was that when you've got money and politics all blended together, you have a potential for problems. And sure enough, that's what happened. You know, these people, these Jews, they prospered, as Rick mentioned a moment ago. They were farmers, they were artisans, they were merchants. But where there's money, there's sometimes greed. And so the greedy got to figure out how to get more. And so here's a guy that came along, a crook by the name of Joseph ben Tobias. And so he went down to the Egyptian authorities and said, I'll give you X percentage of the proceeds that I can collect if you'll give me the right to collect all the taxes back up there in what was called Kole Syria, which included Palestine and Jerusalem. So he played, let's make a deal with that Egyptian authority, and he goes back up there, and therefore he sets up his tax collecting business. And this was in about 230 B.C. They became, that is, he and his family. I realize we backtracked a little bit in terms of the chronology, but you know, we've got to try to fill in all the blanks here, at least some of the blanks that I think are germane. Well, they became very, very powerful people. That's what money sometimes does. More power, more greed, more control. Would you think then that they would be the most likable bunch in the country? Not. Not. And they were very strong proponents of Hellenism. After all, Hellenism is what facilitated their becoming very powerful. So, hey, they figured more Hellenism, and as if we could get the Jews converted to the Greek way of life completely, then, boy, we would have free reign. Well, they obviously then became extremely disliked. In fact, they were hated by the Jews. Even though they had gained some influence, they were not Jews, but they gained some influence in the Jewish community by, again, intermarriage. They married into the family of the high priest, that is, the Tobias and their descendants. They married into the family of the high priest, thinking, again, that's going to be politically expedient. But not only did the Gentiles hate, Jews hate them, but the Gentiles did too. They were just ruthless in their scheming as far as trying to get money and running over other people. And so their oppressive practices and their unscrupulous tax collectors were on the enemy list, so to speak. So you've got more gasoline being thrown on the fire in terms of you've got this going on, you've got Antiochus, and oh, it's a few years later, you know, 20, 30 years later, but still you've got all that political posturing, you've got the fussing and the fighting between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and then you've got Antiochus going back up there and ravaging the temple in Jerusalem, and you've got this just total disdain for the Hellenists that's just fuming, which is a perfect formula for an explosion. And that's basically what happened with the Maccabean revolt, is they just got to the point where they were fed up to hear. And so somebody's going to take the bull by the horns and they're going to, you know, cut loose. And that's what the Maccabeans did. Mattathias was the pappy, and then there were five sons. But Mattathias was the one that started the battle. He was the one that started the revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes. Which gets us to page 32. However, I want to go back and look at the end of Daniel and look at, in fact, and what I would like for you to do between now and next week is over there on our timeline, just note, okay, the citations over here. And just kind of go down through here, and when you see a citation, usually it's going to be in Daniel. In fact, those would be the main ones to read. Look at what we've talked about tonight, and maybe as you look back over this, some of the things that we've said will sort of click. And then go over here in Daniel and read the citations in Daniel and correlate them to what the event that we've been talking about as we discuss some of this tonight. And then we're going to look at a graphic of this, because, as we said, this had a profound effect upon the mindset of the people, in the Jew in particular, in Jesus' day that was looking for the Messiah. It also is a fulfillment of the prophecies that were made by Daniel. And this is one of the most, again, powerful pieces of evidence that we have that God's Word, the Bible that we have, is God's Word, because round numbers, when did Daniel write his book? Or what period of time? All right. The last five, last two-thirds of the 5th century B.C. When did Jesus arrive? About 4 B.C. So over 500 years later. How could God describe all of these particular events and even name the empires, the Persian Empire? Over 150 years before Cyrus was born, he was named as the one that would deliver the Jews from Babylonian captivity. The Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, which would supplant the Persian Empire in the early 300s or late 300s in Alexander. So 200 years later, these empires are named as those that are going to set the stage for the coming of the Messiah another 300 years later. How could that be? Just a lucky guess? Daniel just had a crystal ball? No, these were inspired statements. Every prophecy came from God, Peter said, not by the will of man. So all of these historical events that are either stated specifically or alluded to in the Bible, that we can look at history then and say, yes, here's what Daniel said and here's what happened, then obviously we have to be persuaded, we should be persuaded, that the Bible had to have come from God, because all these prophecies couldn't have just all of a sudden popped onto the pages of some book and then come true hundreds, if not some, in some cases, over 1,000 years after those statements were made. That's the gist of our study, isn't it? Messianic prophecies and the fulfillment of messianic prophecies. The oldest of which, well, I guess if you went all the way back to Genesis 49, we'd be talking the days of Moses. That was written about 1500 B.C. But you know, anywhere from 1500 BC up to 400 BC, over 300 statements were made about Jesus' identity in the time of his coming. And he fulfilled every one of them precisely as it had been stated in the ancient Hebrew scriptures. Now, as we get to the New Testament, and we'll probably be there in 2 or 3 weeks, it's probably going to take us maybe a class to go through the last part of Daniel, and then we want to go over this Maccabean revolt information. Well, I've also got another page that I wrote today, but I'm only handing out one page a week where it saves wear and tear on my collator. I have finally uncovered what I think is some rather interesting information from the Qumran community writings, as well as a couple of things from the Apocrypha, but mostly from Qumran. That's what I wrote, started writing on today. So, where's Qumran? Qumran.
Dead Sea
Scrolls. All right, just check it. Dead Sea Scrolls. So you need to make that connection. Put a dot over here and a dot over here and connect them. All right. Qumran, Dead Sea Scrolls. That's where the Dead Sea Scrolls were.
Dead Sea.
Yeah. In a cave. How many caves were there? Seven. Seven caves at Qumran? Yeah. I know there were at least five. Yeah, well, full of some old scrolls. I did an awful lot of talking tonight and didn't give you a chance to do very much. Questions or comments or observations?
You mentioned that one king went through Jerusalem on his way around, so that got me thinking, how did Jerusalem at this time compare to those other cities that were, you know, we mentioned Alexandria, a magnificent city, and Pergamon and all those. Was Jerusalem comparable to those, or bigger or worse? Or
as far as size?
Just size and reputation. And
well, it had, you know, it had its prominent place throughout the course of history as far as the Jewish community was concerned, because that's where they went every year, three times a year, for, you know, to go to the temple. And there, it's been estimated that there were perhaps as many as 2 million Jews that showed up in Jerusalem on a feast day. You know, but that's a wild guess, but we don't know. But a whole bunch did. So it was a center of activity for, you know, over 1,500 years. Or roughly 1,500 years. And it was also on one of the main roads, one of the main trade routes, coming from Damascus, which came, you know, from the Fertile Crescent down. Now, there was another main road called the King's Highway that was on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. But if they wanted to go to the west through the more populous region, they came down through this region on their way to Egypt. So it was a prominent city. Now, as far, I don't know I've ever seen any numbers about size. That would be something for a studious Googler to look up, wouldn't it? I found so many different numbers about the size of the Persian Empire, I just finally picked a number. Because, again, I think there's a lot of unknowns still about that period of time. We got a lot of information, but there's a lot of things we don't know.
One thing that amazed me is how much devastation that you call Antiochus.
Oh, yeah, 3 years or less, yeah. Really, it's a little over
5 years, like back to the...
Yeah, total, but, I mean, the worst of it was a little over a year before the Maccabean revolt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just...
I mean, he was on a tear. He was Yeah, ripping and snorting and tearing everything up he could get, you know, it was in his sights. And you can imagine, again, you can understand why the Jews hated him so much. And why the Holy Spirit would inspire Daniel to say as much about that period of time as he did in the latter portion of Daniel, particularly the 10th, 11th, and 12th chapters of Daniel. Which, again, being written in apocalyptic language, it's hard to connect the dots until you study the history, the secular history. Then it's easier to understand what Daniel was talking about because he wrote it in code. Right. Right. It's just a whole lot like studying the book of Revelation. Which we already did that. So. How long has it been? Somebody asked me today. How long ago did we study Revelation?
3 years.
3 or 4 years ago? Yeah. Anything else?